coming up on TechNation, with all these AI chatbots around, how did computers learn to write? It's neither magic nor mystery, says Columbia professor Dennis Yee Tenen. Then, if all this technology is so great, why are we still using pen and paper? Regular contributor Dr. Alex Pang gives us insights on humans and technology. Remember, there was a time when paper itself was an exciting new technology. And TechNation Health chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about food as medicine. And with today's tech, we can tell how our bodies react to different foods. All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2010, I spoke with Bill Bryson about his book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life. While reading his book, it became clear to me that the history of how humans live their private lives is really the history of household technology.
Well, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, the history of houses is really, as the point I make in the book, is the history of everything. I mean, you can look at it, domesticity from a biological standpoint, from a social standpoint, from a technological standpoint, and yet we never look at it really from any standpoints. I mean, you know, the history of private life is something that doesn't get taught in schools. It doesn't really feature on any radar anywhere. And that was the whole idea of the book, was that, you know, I had spent the whole of my formative years in school learning about the history of the world from the perspective of wars and diplomacy and big, kind of big global events, things happening on a big tapestry. But actually, when you stop and think about all of those things, where they ultimately end up, the achievements of history end up in our homes.
And everybody has to be somewhere. Everybody has a home.
Everybody has a home. And homes are oddly recognizable. I mean, I don't go on into this very much in the book, but it is a strange thing. Wherever you go in the world, if you're just dropped into an unfamiliar environment, you can recognize the homes. You can distinguish homes very quickly, even though a lot of times homes, you know, are not terribly distinguishable in terms of architecture. There is something about an atmosphere of domesticity that we all know. And it's very, very hard to define what makes a house or what makes a residence, because it can be so many different things. I mean, it can be all really essentially an infinite number of materials. It can be, you know, any kind of shape. It can be all kinds of things. And yet we know a home when we see it.
Your jumping off point is your actual home in England. Tell us about it.
Well, the whole idea, Mario, was that in 2003, after living in New Hampshire for 8 years, I moved back to England with my English wife and kids, and we ended up living in a former Church of England parsonage in Norfolk, in East Anglia. And while I was sitting there, soon after we arrived, I was kicking around ideas for books. I needed to come up with an idea for a new book. And I was actually sitting at the kitchen table and just idly fingering the salt and pepper shakers on the table. And I thought, why those two? Why do we always have salt and pepper on every kitchen table I've ever sat at? You know, I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa. We had salt and pepper on the table. I live in England now. We had salt and pepper on the table. Why those two? Why not salt and cinnamon or pepper and cardamom or any other combination of things? And that was my kind of starting point, was thinking that, you know, actually, I don't know anything about houses and how they're organized and really the histories behind these everyday objects that we are immersed in all the time. So the whole idea of the book became, I'll make a trip. I'll travel around my own house, this old parsonage in England, and I'll just go from room to room, and I'll write a history of the earth from the perspective of each room, so that the bathroom would be a history of hygiene and kitchen the history of cooking, bedroom would be sex and death and sleeping, whatever happened in history in those rooms, and see where that takes us. And I had no idea what I might be embarking upon.
And how old is the parsonage?
It was built in 1851, so it's about 160 years.
And you had blueprints from the original parsonage.
You know, I was lucky that it was a Church of England property, because that meant we had a pretty good record of both the original plans had been saved, because the Church of England held on to all of these things, because otherwise they might have been lost at some point in the last century and a half. And also we had a complete record of occupants from, you know, we knew the names of all of, through the Church of England, knew the names of all the rectors who had lived in this house from 1851 up until the 1970s, when it was sold off. Church of England found it very hard to keep these grand old parsonages. It was they're quite expensive houses for country parsons, and so they began the early 20th century. They began to sell them off little by little.
You've been listening to a 2010 Tech Nation interview with Bill Bryson about his book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life. With the COVID-19 pandemic and global sheltering in place, the technologies in our home are distinctly unprecedented. Bill Bryson's latest book is The Body, A Guide for Occupants. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, former Microsoft software engineer Dr. Dennis Yee Tenen is now a professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He's here today with Literary Theory for Robots, How Computers Learn to Write. But if this technology is all that great, why are we still using pen and paper? Regular contributor Dr. Alex Pang has an answer for that. And TechNation Health chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about food as medicine and how today's tech can tell us how we react differently to different foods. And in that sense, it's all about your health.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Dr. Dennis Yee Tenen. Well, Professor Yee Tenen, welcome to Tech Nation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, I have to say, I changed the first question of this interview several times. So fortunately, now this is the first question as of now. If we kept this going on, I'd be changing it.
Okay.
But one thing that occurred to me after reading your book, I was thinking that a substantive problem with artificial intelligence, now that it's gone to the masses, the term itself, is that we call it artificial in the first place.
Right, right. Somewhere in there I write that, this assumes this kind of non-artificial natural intelligence. And I don't understand, or I don't see where we would find this, because from a very young age, anytime we think, we're constantly using tools, we're constantly using other people. Most of the things I know by reaching for a book. And kind of the natural part is just a small part of what intelligence is.
Now, if you're a computer scientist, you're taught that computers started with Charles Babbage and Lady Ada Lovelace and the difference engine, the analytical engine. But that's more about processing of information and words and numbers, which are actually handled the same way pretty much. This is about developing methods for encoding knowledge and the relationship of words and terms to each other. In your book, you learn this has been going on for centuries.
Yes, I think one of the earliest examples I have is a medieval device called the Zairaja, and it's well documented in all over the Muslim world and in Spain, in Europe, medieval Europe, and elsewhere. And what you see is people using machines. They're paper machines, circles with different kind of letters in them, and you rotate them, and you ask them questions, and they produce a rhymed response. And so this one philosopher, Ibn Khaldun, he documents talking to one of these devices, and he says, yeah, it produces kind of a neat answer. It seems profound. And he kind of, he thinks maybe it is actually doing something, or maybe it's a trick. And it's not so dissimilar from the way we today feel kind of anxiety and wonder in playing with contemporary AIs.
Well, talking about contemporary AIs, it was only November of 2022 when ChatGPT made the scene, big splash. A couple hundred million people suddenly were on it, and we have Gemini AI, which is the formal Google Bard, and it might even be Gemini. I don't know. Google will have to tell us. Neuroflash, Rightsonic, Copy.ai. I mean, there's just a whole lot of them out there. How is it possible that all these AI tools which generate text could happen in a year, just 1 year?
Well, you know, that's a little bit, I'm trying to argue against that feeling that we have that all of a sudden technology takes a leap. And in reality, what you see is a slow progress and a slow kind of development, evolution of technology. So, for example, we've been using grammar correction for a long time. And I'm sure when grammar correction came out, like that was pretty amazing. Or even spelling correction, you get that red squiggly line in your Microsoft Word, in your Google Docs. And that's a pretty wondrous technology. And how do we get that technology? Well, you need dictionaries. And dictionaries took hundreds of years to perfect. And when dictionaries came out, you know, when Webster's came out or kind of the major dictionaries, that was also a monumental achievement in human, sort of human thought and human collective human intelligence. So once you see it as a gradual process, every step of it seems pretty miraculous and pretty wondrous.
And well before you ever thought to try out one of these, you would be typing along and suddenly your computer would suggest what the next few words are. It's not that big a leap to writing a whole sentence.
Right, the predictive completion. So it predicts, predicts a word, predicts a sentence, and then thinking, okay, well, this has to eventually predict a paragraph or a whole novel.
Well, that's a good question. How much of your book was generated by AI?
Very little. You know, I originally did include passages that were, they were labeled, but they were actually not very interesting. And so I didn't tell my editor which ones those were, and she got them right away. And she said, no, get rid of these.
Well, you know, it's funny because I know you're a professor. I'm a professor. You have to have had students turn in papers that were generated by AI. Were you able to tell?
You know, I haven't seen one in the wild yet. And partly the way I do assignments, it kind of, it really discourages that kind of, you would be able to tell right away. So I think, I hope my students know better. But yeah, you know, I can't remember. It's not in this book. Maybe it's in the, I have an academic version of this book coming as well. And I begin that one with a talk I gave in Kyrgyzstan on AI. And this was just when ChatGPT-4 came out. And so there was a lot of excitement. And all the faculty, the professors wanted to talk about, you know, the usage in essays and how everybody's going to cheat. And then one of the students raised their hand and said, you know, already my classmates are just paying somebody to write their papers anyway. And like, I can't really afford that. But now, like, this is great. Now I can afford for someone to write a paper. And this is actually like a really fair technology because it equalizes the playing field. And that was a really interesting insight about how, you know, again, what intelligence is not just kind of innate. It's something that's produced. And because it's something that's produced, it can also be purchased.
Well, I've had a couple of students try it, and maybe more, and I just didn't see it. But my favorite one was something that every person in the class, two classes actually, had to write something about a different company. And basically, the second line of the whole paper was always, Joe Smith is the CEO of this company. And I knew right away, because the second sentence was, at the helm of this endeavor... Nobody writes like this. Nobody writes like this.
Maybe Homer.
That's right. That's right. You write, procedurally generated text can make grammatical sense, but might not always make sense.
Right. Well, that comes from Chomsky. And, you know, there's a specific lineage of trying to solve that problem. The early text generators in the late 50s and early 60s, they quite quickly managed to sort of make grammatically correct sentences. So that was solved pretty early on. But then making sure that those sentences are semantically correct and then making sure that two sentences in a row actually relate to each other, like that was a huge problem that really wasn't solved until recently.
Now, you also write, how could we verify the results of any machine to produce knowledge in excess of our own intellectual capacity? What if the smarts generated by a mechanism turned out to be nonsense?
Right. So that particular question comes almost directly from Descartes, though I expand on it. So So the idea is that imagine true superintelligence, like you are an ant and you're trying to evaluate a discourse by a human. I mean, point is, it will sound to you like complete gibberish. So true beyond human intelligence has to be out of our reach. So that's kind of an interesting, I think, an unsettling moment. And maybe actually it's not very interesting. I mean, elsewhere, the way I finish it, like imagine watching the Olympics where robots are racing like faster than you can see them. I mean, at some point you just lose interest. The Olympics are not interesting because, right, because like some, it's interesting because we are pushing human abilities to the limit. Once you get into some kind of supersonic missiles, like that's not something that we're it's not particularly compelling for humans.
You also point out there are certain areas in which other aspects of AI are really helpful, really move things along. And in biotech, I am always pressing my guests to say, oh, AI, what exactly are you doing? Is that really AI or a really large spreadsheet? You know, it's like,
right.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, in biotech, going back to your original idea, well, how do you know it's true? You know, it's like in biotech, you can always take that drug it thinks it's discovered and take it into the lab and say, oh, it really does work that way, or it doesn't work that way, and we can take it into humans. So there's a hard stop. Have you generated something we just couldn't see? And, it turns out to be true. So I have a lot of confidence, I should say, in that kind of AI, because
right.
You don't introduce it into the system, even into the knowledge system, until you actually test it. But you kind of wonder about the rest.
Right. Well, also, you know, I think the kind of process you're describing also is that there is a way in which technology in general, and in many ways, AI started just being a synonym for technology, just like some smart thing that enables you to work. But technology just rises all boats of intelligence. So like we all are kind of more literate as the result. And so I have a bit less anxiety about, you know, ChatGPT and other software or other technology, because I think it's a way for us to sort of accelerate our shared collective possibilities. You know, I don't mind getting like more literate emails from like random students, and the fact they're spelled correctly automatically, like that's great. And I also have faith that exceptional capacity. So, you know, when the average capacity, for example, to spell things correctly rises, it kind of becomes also banal and boring and everyday, and we forget about it, just like we forget about the grammar correction. But the exceptional capacity always ends up bubbling up. And so some people like are really great at using, I don't know, Microsoft Word or ChatGPT or whatever, you know, biotechnology for finding drugs. And that's also great. So I have faith in human ability to rise above the average. And by definition, AI in the way we use it is kind of that average intelligence. It's the average sort of like our average ability to write or to find information, something like that.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Dennis Yitenin, an associate professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. A former Microsoft software engineer, he's affiliated with Columbia's Data Science Institute. He's here today with Literary Theory for Robots, How Computers Learned to Write. Another topic that you took up was ethics in AI, ethical AI. And there's sort of an impossibility in there, if I should say it that. Maybe impossibility is the wrong word here. Just take it from there.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm somewhat resistant to talking about ethics in AI, because partly I think, you know, already from the beginning of our conversation, the way we are using AI as if it's one thing, but it's actually not one thing. It's multiple very different technologies. And even ChatGPT itself has like, you know, a long sort of stack of different technologies that, you know, it seems to us like one thing, but that actually many different pieces of software made by many different teams. And so essentially, and that's part of the way I finished the book, is to say that, you know, these tools are made by people, and they're made by companies, and they're made by teams. And so imagine writing something, And behind you, there are like 10 editors. So, you know, and they're just like in real time. They're going like, no, don't, you know, or like, here's a better. Let me give you a suggestion to finish the sentence. And so you're writing in this collective way. But what software allows you to do is to have a team of helpers, but they're remote. They're just not immediately in the room. And, you know, and so they're a little bit hidden behind the curtain, you know, like in a book. And they're giving this help remotely. And the fact that it's, you know, those things are called ChatGPT or Microsoft Word or whatever it is, it confuses us and closes the fact that really what's happening is a type of shared collective labor. And I think part of my job is to say, wait a second, let's open up that screen a little bit and remind ourselves that this is a human collective endeavor.
And it's been a human collective endeavor for decades, centuries. You can trace these things if you look at labor, look and what has done to society. You write, in the industrial age, automation came for the shoemaker and the factory line worker. Today, it has come for the writer, the professor, the physician, and the attorney. So the jig is up. We professors are out of work.
Well, no, that's not what I meant. I meant the jig is up. We professors are workers. I mean, I think seeing, you know, so seeing the
what?
But I mean, it's seeing the work of an intellect as labor. I think it's much less surprising that we are subject to the same kind of processes of automation and replacement. I mean, you know, factory workers had to deal with this since the industrial age for over a century. So it's just it reaches. Automation reaches intellectual work much later. But you know, I'm sorry, just to go back to that, I did want to finish a thought from your previous question, is that the ethics ultimately, once you reveal the human presence, and once you reveal labor in this question, implicit in this question here, we're back into the realm of human ethics. So once you understand that you're working with other people and that a lot of the products of intellectual labor are now just distributed. They're most of the things we write in teams. And actually, that's also been so for a long time. And once you kind of see the humans behind technology, I think we're back to the kind of ethics that we more readily understand. Or we have the language and the legal framework to discuss those kind of ethical problems.
Well, this really does flow into the concept of the accumulation of work over time. I mean, I can look at my laptop here and think about all the people and all the ideas and all the labor that went in to making it, not just manufacturing it at the end, but years and years and years of people using it and refining it and humans reusing it and say, we like it this way and not that way. Then there's the application we're looking at each other on and recording this. You know, if we actually look around, very little really just started with our own endeavor, by our own hand.
Right. You know, at Columbia, I have to teach in the core where we read, you know, the kind of the classics of Western philosophy. And just this week, we were reading Rousseau. And we're also next week, we're reading Adam Smith. And both Rousseau and Adam Smith, they have these passages where they're like, look around you, like look at the microphone, look at the pen, look at, you know, a pair of pants and think. And then they go through and sort of enumerate how many people it took to get that product to your desk, to your house. And you know, it ends up being thousands. And I think that's the kind of making their contribution visible as well. It's very difficult because it seems like we're surrounded by these dead passive objects, but actually these objects, they reveal quite a bit of thought about their user. So, you know, like a simple pen or a spoon, like the handle is shaped in a particular way because somebody thought about the shape of your hand. And that's a designer that maybe is long dead and is far away from us, but they do attempt to reach out. And so I think kind of bringing back that wonder about physical objects and about technology is a way to also return to labor, return to the questions of ethics that are written out, that, you know, I don't know if this microphone has ethics, but once you start thinking about where it came from.
The people who build it did. The people who use it do.
Who build it and who deliver it and who I mean, there's a whole supply chain that involves hundreds, if not thousands of people.
So you are never alone. Think of it that way.
You're never alone. That's right. That's right.
Unfortunately, they can't talk to you, which I like that. I like that part. I'll just wave. Yes. I'll just wave. Yeah. And actually, for those of you who are like, oh, no, you know, really, our jobs really over with our professions? You make a very good point. Those that remain will also find their work enriched. So you may be these things, but you'll be operating at a whole new level.
Yeah, I think, you know, a good example of this that happened kind of within the last, let's say, 10, 20 years is digital photography. So when, you know, when we sort of began, you know, however, you know, maybe 20 years ago, when digital photography became sort of ubiquitous and every phone had started having an amazing camera, people thought, oh, photography is going to be dead. You'll never need a wedding photographer again because every guest will have like amazing photographs. Well, that didn't really turn out to be true. Now, the average wedding photographer today is way more sophisticated than 20 years ago. They're bringing in drones. They're putting together like much more interesting clips, or they're editing videos. So what it means to be a photographer, the bar has been raised, and it coexists with also, you know, hundreds of your wedding dinner guests also taking photos. So I don't see an impoverishment here. You just see kind of a more exciting life for photography. Subsequent to digital photography.
Now, you write about chatbots and the Russian aggression in Ukraine. How are they being used? And you also refer to your own efforts in this area. Tell us about that.
So this is a difficult, you know, and personally difficult thing to talk about. But some of my work now is I'm really paying close attention in the way chatbots and troll farms are being used, usually in the public discursive spaces like YouTube comments or Facebook or Telegram channels. And so these, well, let's call them armies of bots are being mobilized to influence public opinion and often destabilize processes like fair elections in various countries. So it's a complicated and quite a clandestine type of activity. And I think it really requires, you know, there are scholars who attempt to, in various ways, describe this ecosystem. Does AI have consciousness, and will it kill us or something? Like, I'm not really worried about that. But having state agents really using bots in mass by, you know, really sort of flooding the airways, flooding the comment sections with particular sentiment that's designed to make us more angry and designed to divide us. And so paying attention to those kind of uses of AI and automated tools, I think it's quite important. And so I'd like to, I think studying them, reflecting on them, describing them in great detail is something I can do as a scholar.
I'm speaking with Columbia professor Dennis Yee-Tennen. His book is Literary Theory for Robots, How Computers Learn to Write. We'll talk more after a break. Both Whole Tech Nation programs and Biotech Nation only interviews are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com and biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, Dr. Alex Pang tells us why using pen and paper may be permanently a part of our lives. And Dr. Daniel Kraft tells us exactly why food is medicine and when it's not. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with former Microsoft software engineer and present-day Columbia English and Comparative Literature professor Dennis Yi Tenen. We've been talking about chatbots and social media in the conflict in Ukraine and how he's been studying them.
One thing about the wars today, and the Ukrainian war in particular, is there's an amazing direct archive of people who are on the front lines, of people who are experiencing violence, and they're right away recording it, and right away you have a conversation that grows around that particular, you know, those the various small events in the war. And so I've been collecting such events, and I've been translating them, and you know, it's everything from official communiques between, you know, between soldiers and their superiors. It's the words of a grieving mother. It's you know, some sort of an announcement, but they're snippets from the war in a way that to me feels like I've never, you know, to have this immediate access to such material. And I think making them, translating them and collecting them in some way feels important. And again, it feels, I always think like, what can I do from far away to help Ukraine? And that seems like, you know, it's a project that I'd like to pursue going forward, just translating and publishing these notes.
It has all the elements of, we've never seen anything like this before. It could make a big difference.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, there is a whole other interesting conversation we can have about war literature and especially Ukrainian war literature. You know, like Isaac Babel, who is translated into English, is a wonderful war writer, but certainly not to this extent and not in this immediacy. And there are so many ordinary voices which, when translated, because of the rawness of their experience, when you sort of write it down on paper, and when you translate it, they really gain this kind of both significance and poetry that really, you know, struck me as, you know, it really moves me in some way, and I hope to maybe someday to share that with others here.
You alluded to this earlier when you were saying, well, ooh, you know, when Spellcheck was new, that was just really the most exciting thing, and what's going to happen next. And you're reminding us that these chatbots and the AI that we can suddenly all use, it's new technology, and it's having a moment now. It will subside.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you already see that the cycle of hype around AI already you know, has begun to subside, and so that's when you look at the history of artificial intelligence, when it became like its own field of study, sometime in the, you know, late 50s, 60s, when people kind of self-consciously began to say, we're studying, you know, we're developing AI, and you see that kind of research goes through cycles, and these cycles, they're you know, it's kind of funny in a way, because those cycles are cycles of great hype, and I think great metaphysical overpromise. So at every stage, there seems to be, you know, we're inventing Skynet that will, you know, either solve all of our problems or kill us, or perhaps somehow both. So, yeah. And you know, and you see that also it leaks into, you know, like think of, you know, Terminator. Like there's always like movies that give voice to those kind of anxieties and hopes. And then it, you know, the tools turn out to be slightly less than the metaphysical promise. But what remains, I think, is actual, you know, like the practices of writing. I mean, if we specifically look at writer's tools and think about even within our lifetimes, how the practice of writing has changed from, you know, I was taught to write in cursive on paper. And now mostly I very rarely do this. And when I come to a whiteboard with chalk, I'm like embarrassed at how, you know, it's difficult and I have to think about it. I'm so used to having access to all of those tools that, you know, when I write. But overall, I think, you know, I think my writing has gotten better. And nowadays when I write, you know, I do use ChatGPT and other tools when I write, but I usually use them not to generate text, but to talk to someone. So I say like, what do you think of this idea? Or what would be, and you sort of begin, you have this ready conversational partner that sort of does not get tired at all and doesn't get annoyed for, you know, usually I would just like get my partner and ask her like, what do you think of this sentence? She'll be like, stop okay, this is, a thousand times you ask me, like, stop, I'm trying to do something here. But the ChatGPT that is there to, like, land a helpful year. And sometimes that's all I need to, get me past a difficult passage.
So this actually takes my "you are never alone, but they don't talk to me." It's like, oh, but now we got one that does. And it's available at 2 a.m. if that's when you want to ask it.
Right.
It doesn't say, I got work to do, got to go. I'm there. You're not taking its work and trying to pawn it off as yours. I think you've opened a lot of people's eyes. One final thing I wanted to say is most people will think, oh my gosh, this has got to be, some big tome, and this is only 161 pages of reading in a small book. Was this just the right size for this?
It is the right size, and I have to, give a big thanks to Norton, the publishing company. Norton is a great American institution, and it's an independent, employee-owned publisher. So I really dearly love the press themselves, and they were launched, in, forgive me if I get the date wrong, but early 20th century, with the work of I.A. Richards and Malinowski, and other scholars who are writing these short, accessible books for the public. And so originally, when the editors reached out to me, they asked me to rewrite Richards's, I think the book was called Science and Poetry, or Sciences and Poetry by Richards. So, my attempt, and I read it, I said, let me think about it. I read it, and then I tried to sort of reimagine it for the 21st century. But the book from the beginning was conceived as a short book, and I hope it contains, besides some reflection and a lot of nerdy history, I think it contains, I try to really bring the characters to life, and I try to keep the, to really cram a lot of that history into kind of a package that hopefully is interesting for people to read and is entertaining as well.
Nice little package all right here. Very clever. Very clever. Dennis, you're always welcome on Tech Nation. We do want to hear back from you when you're ready to talk about the information you're now collecting from Ukraine. And I'm just pleased you were able to come on. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
My guest today is Columbia professor Dennis Yitenin. His book is Literary Theory for Robots: How Computers Learn to Write. It's published by W.W. Norton. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. I love my computer and my smartphone and all kinds of digital technology. And yet, I also like one particular kind of pen and constantly use one particular kind of small paper notepad. And yes, I have a small stapler, which I can carry with me if I'm going on an extended business trip. Why am I tied to these physical vestiges of the past? Regular contributor Dr. Alex Pang has been thinking about this very human tendency for quite some time. Alex, good to see you.
Hey, great to see you too, Moira.
Now, we were talking, and you mentioned something that really intrigued me. You said, with all the technology we have, why are we still using notebooks? I mean, you don't mean by that a small laptop. You mean pencil and paper or pen and paper.
Right.
That is a really good question. Why?
This is something that I've been thinking about for a while, because I am one of those people who loves notebooks, right? I have very strong opinions about one brand versus versus the other, and what features I like in them. And I'm also, you can't do that without also having a favorite kind of pen or a favorite fountain pen. But I'm also someone who really likes experimenting with all kinds of digital tools. And, I have to make a lot of choices about, do I do something in print? Do I do it digitally? Do I do it like on smart paper so that I've got both the physical thing and the digital one? And where I come down is that, it seems to me that physical notebooks turn out to have a kind of longevity for a couple reasons. One is that they are incredibly cheap and incredibly flexible, right? Cheap in the sense that, you know, sort of a paper notebook, a really nice one is like $10, $15 in contrast to, to an electronic equivalent that can be, you know, 100 times that. But and flexible in the sense that you can use it in all sorts of different ways. It's something that's really easy to experiment with, to integrate into daily practices, to carry around, to have available with you sort of as you go about your day and as you're thinking and sort of working. I think also that there is, you know, there's some science that suggests that our brains kind of process and remember things differently when we write them down by hand versus when we, you know, type them out on sort of a computer or, you know, do the little thing with our thumbs on, you know, on our phones. And at least if you're like me, spell half the words incorrectly.
That, yeah.
You know, writing things down on paper kind of ironically helps you remember them better than you would if you were, you know, than when you're doing them digitally. And there's a little bit of evidence that maybe it helps with some deep thinking. So I think that, and you know, I think that that you know, there is also still advantages in the kind of just the physical portability of, you know, of notebooks that we can't underestimate. I went on a trip not long ago with one of these, you know, digital pads with a, you know, with a smart pencil, and it's really, really cool technology. It works very well, but I kept finding that the fact that it's like this solid piece of titanium and plastic made it just challenging enough to work with on an airplane or on the train that, you know, it was just hard enough to write on that it sort of discouraged me from using it in places where I would have had no problem whipping out, you know, sort of the pen and my notebook. The other thing with those systems is that the pens themselves are good, but they often are kind of a design afterthought, right? And they're still treated more like a sort of stylus than the kind of writing instrument that notebook lovers love and love to make choices about. And so I think that, you know, that for those of us who enjoy the act of writing, that there's really still, despite decades of trying to reproduce it on screens, still nothing quite like putting pen to paper.
Well, I gotta say, Alex, you know, a little confession here from Tech Nation. It's like, I'm gonna hold this up. You can see it. You know, these are one of these small legal pads, not the little ones. We live off this. Not only do we have that, we have little staplers. So it goes, you know, one, two, rip it apart and, you know, staple it all together. And then we put it with whatever, you know, interview we're doing or the project we're working on. And what I find you can't do with the stylus and the trying to make all that work is you can't like flip back really easily while you're talking to somebody, whether on the screen or in person. You can't take the arrow and like, I'm going to run it to the top of the page. I'm going to put it back up there. I mean, you still have to kind of find it and whatever. You can't continue your conversation, at least at this point in the technology, and perhaps someone can prove if ever. It's like there are some things that work really, really well with pen and paper.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a fact.
You know, there's a fantastic classic book called The Myth of the Paperless Office that, you know, and this came out by now almost 20 years ago, I think. And it asked the question, why is it that in an age of computers, you know, sort of allegedly paperless offices, paper is still everywhere? And what the authors, Abigail Sellin and Richard Harper, argue that paper survives mainly because of the affordances of the medium, by which I mean that, you know, it's cheap, it's easy to transport, sort of you can flip back and forth, but also there's a kind of sociability to those affordances. And like in air traffic control centers, they studied one of these that, you know, manages flights going across the Atlantic. And you would think this would be an incredibly high-tech operation, but actually it's a bank of the radar screens that you would imagine. And they managed the planes using slips of paper. And that sounds crazy at first, but this was really important because one of the things that you always want to know is who is responsible for which plane, right? Who's got eyes on, you know, or to flight 27. And so whenever you are responsible for a plane, you have this, you have that slip of paper on your desk. And what that means is that a manager can see really easily if, you know, because of bad weather, someone's got an awful lot of planes that they're responsible for, and they can take a few of those slips and give them to another controller. And the act of moving those things is a really clear message about who is responsible for the sort of for this. That's something that turned out to be really hard to replicate digitally. But, you know, for this particular purpose, for guaranteeing that you knew who had eyes on which plane, right, paper turned out to be incredibly valuable. And so I think that very often when you see paper surviving in whether it's lawyers' offices or construction sites or, you know, classrooms, it's not because there haven't been attempts to create digital versions of whether it's textbooks or medical records, et cetera. It's because the affordances of paper turn out to still give it advantages that, or of even in our digital world, remain unique.
Well, we don't have the time, but we'll talk about it another time about what humans can do and not do with technology. And I'll tell you a story, but that's got to wait, I'm afraid, Alex. Thanks for coming in. We'll see you next time.
All right. Look forward to it.
Regular contributor Dr. Alex Pang is a champion of the 4-day work week. His most recent book is Rest, Why You Get More Work Done When You Work Less. More information is available on his website, strategy.rest. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. We're always on the lookout for the latest, greatest in biotech, not just to intervene with the challenges we humans have, but also how it can tell us about ourselves. Dr. Daniel Kraft wants us to consider food as medicine, not some specialized, created food, but how different everyday foods can interact given our specific genetic makeup, and how personal technology can easily help us measure it. In fact, constantly measure it. And not just when we have a medical condition, this can lead us to significant changes in our very own lives. It may inform us, in fact, about how and what we feed our children, even from the earliest days when we first introduce food to our babies. TechNation Health Chief Correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft. Hey, Daniel, welcome back.
Great to be back, Moira.
Now, we have talked about, and I want to talk about today, food as medicine. I mean, as we all grew up, there was food and there was medicine. How do the circles on the Venn diagram push that together to food as medicine?
Well, I think what counts as food has changed. In my era as a child, Twinkies were food. I'm not sure if they still count in that realm. And I think we've increasingly recognized everything old is new again. Some ancient adages. Hippocrates, the famous Greek physician and philosopher, said, "Let food be thy medicine and let medicine be thy food." And we're learning how important nutrition is, something we don't get a lot of education in medical school, by the way, and how it plays such a key role in all sorts of diseases or prevention or recovery. And we're now in this sort of, I think, emerging golden age of precision nutrition, where we can start to take some of these new tools and technologies and really optimize our nutrition to both optimize our health span, prevent disease, and manage acute and chronic conditions.
Now, let's flip this on the other side. If we are eating a lot of ultra-processed food, treated food, there may be chemicals in food from pesticides. Is that really going to hurt us? Do we know?
Well, I think there's a lot of ties to our environment, to pesticides, to what hormones beef might be getting fed, or your chickens that develop the eggs you might have for breakfast. We know that plastics that we ingest in often what we think are safe water bottles are potentially playing havoc and catalyzing everything from cancer to autoimmune diseases. So I think there's always room to improve. I think there's the old adage, you know, stick with the basics, not too much, the right balance. And what is being portrayed as the right balance by nutrition cycles has changed over time. And I think, like many elements of healthcare, we want to be at less one size fits all, but more tuned to the individual. And I think what's getting exciting now is we're entering the era of, it's often called, you know, metabolic health. You can wear a pretty low cost continuous glucose monitor, even if you're not a diabetic, and get a flavor about how certain foods are impacting your blood sugar and the spikes. White rice might give you a much higher spike than, let's say, a whole grain rice. We're learning the impact of certain foods early in individuals' lives. So putting on my pediatrician hat, if you give a child at 6 months of age, when they start to eat their first solid foods, you don't give them that, you know, white rice kind of low cost, tasty Gerber cereal, you give them a whole grain version. The whole grain version changes the microbiome of their gut, their epigenetics, and their risk for obesity and diabetes downstream can go way down just from a very simple early start in life with the right food. So some of it can be sort of generalized, but now using tools like continuous glucose monitors, looking at someone's underlying genome, maybe even analyzing their microbiome, the bugs that live on their skin and their mouth and the gut, can really start to enable us to pick and measure the metabolism and optimize a diet to lose weight or to train for a marathon or to live a longer, healthier life.
Well, this can get pretty individualized. How do we measure what's going on inside us?
Well, if you look on the App Store, there's now thousands of sort of health-related apps. Many of them are diet-related. They enable you to log your meals, maybe do intermittent fasting if you think that might play a role in health or longevity. And now there's a whole next generation of AI-empowered apps that can take a video or picture of your food in real time, tell you that that's broccoli or a banana or a donut, and track that for you, which is important in some meal planning. So that's a way of measuring your inputs. You can often even use a low-cost spectrophotometer to tell you whether that food might have glutens in it or peanuts, which you might be allergic to. So you can measure inputs. And now we can measure our outputs. In the hospital setting, we call them ins and outs. We use those to look at the, let's say, the fluid balance of a patient. But now we're starting to see sensored toilets. I like to call them poopables, very exotic term.
All right.
But now if you're at the Consumer Electronics Show the last couple of years, you'll see next generation Toto toilets and platforms from companies like WeThings that will be inserted in your toilet and track the health of your urine, or cameras that can look at the number two and predict how your diet's going, or signs of cancer, or maybe pick up blood or changes in stool habits that might be indicative. So no one wants to look at that data real time. It's a bit messy, but when you can start to quantify that and track, we might pick up problems early, and everything from early kidney disease to early GI issues. And that might be part of our sort of censored, personalized health and nutrition era going forward.
Well, certainly if it could pick up blood in the stool before anybody sees it and or has other indications to go and look at that, that would be a really positive outcome.
Well, we know many folks skip their colonoscopies or don't even do the basic stool tests. So if we can kind of hit the easy button, you know, a lot of these new emergent digital health tools and technologies and med tech can start to pick up our vital signs, look at a picture of your face and pick up a challenge or a genetic issue. And as our sensor toilets and refrigerators and those blend with AI and VR and augmented reality, we could start to potentially pick up issues earlier and use those as easy modalities to intervene. And for example, with back to the diet issue, now with sort of simple tools, even those on Snapchat, you can see the ones that make you older or skinnier or more overweight. when you can see not just you of today in the mirror or in the app, but see future you and can make yourself skinnier or fatter, that might be a good modus for catalyzing that behavior change when you've decided to get on that diet, you want to stick with it. So nutrition, of course, is very personalized. Sometimes it's driven by our genetics. We're obviously a whole other topic in the now in the era of GLP-1 inhibitors, which is a huge game changer for obesity and weight loss. But the ability to engage with your health and your data and personalize both your nutrition, your exercise, and your holistic care is super tied to our nutrition. And I'm excited to see what's going to emerge as we kind of use new modalities where you can even eat to beat disease or undo diseases using those modalities. One example where food is medicine has been pioneered by my friend, Dr. Dean Ornish, who now has a Medicare reimbursed diet plan to help patients who have advanced heart disease reverse their heart disease with certain diets, mindfulness, groups, love and connection. So we're starting to see the importance of, you know, going back to the basics for reversing disease, and often folks who are excited in longevity and health span to use our diets to kind of keep us at a healthy weight and to extend our healthy health spans well into the 90s and beyond.
Well, it all seems to start with don't get off the path of eating really good food. Don't let it be bad. Be good.
Right. Michael Pollan, I think I'm going to not get the quote right, as you know, eat lots of green foods like your mother told you and in a good variety, and pay attention also to feeding your microbiome, such an important part of our gut health. We can start to understand and measure the microbiome today, understand its roles in everything from inflammatory bowel disease to risk for cancers. We know that diseases like ulcers are basically a microbiome disease caused by H. pylori. So you treat that now with antibiotics, not surgery as it was done before. So as we understand gut health and nutrition and holistic integrative care, it's an exciting time for everyone to get involved in their nutrition and leverage that to improve their overall health and activity and hopefully tie that to the health of the planet, because we spend a lot of our energy and our greenhouse gases on making food as well.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much for coming in. I can't wait for next time.
All right. See you next time.
TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of NextMed Health, on the web at nextmed.health and digital.health. More information about Daniel at danielkraftmd.net. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment, BiotechNation, are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.